Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Amy Dickinson. Dickinson has worked as a producer for NBC News, a columnist for Time magazine, and she contributes commentaries and stories to NPR's All Things Considered. She became the Chicago Tribune's successor to the legendary Ann Landers with the debut of her Ask Amy advice column in July of 2003. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thanks, Tish.
So nice to see you here. I want to begin with the fact that you were born and raised on a dairy farm in Freeville, New York, that's been in your family since 1790. Tell us about that upbringing.
Well, the farm hasn't, although we do occupy the same land that my family got in as a, I think, a Revolutionary War land grant. So Freeville is a tiny little village. And its population is 452. When my daughter and I are here, we're like, are we 452 or 454? We have to look into it. But my whole family lives in the village. And I grew up on a very small dairy farm. We had about 65 head of Holstein, just on the fringes of town.
Mm-hmm. And so the way you describe your family, in something I read, you describe your family as a hilarious, short-waisted Methodist.
All true, yes. Very, exceedingly short-waisted, quite hilarious, and definitely Methodist, yes.
Uh-huh. And what's so hilarious about it? Constantly joking, or?
We're not real jokey, but we think we're hilarious, but maybe that would be best for others to judge. But no, I mean, I was just with family last night, and we were howling. We amuse one another. Let me put it that way.
Uh-huh. Well, that's sort of rare in this day and age.
I think it is.
For families to enjoy each other's
yes.
company. Now, according to your biography, too, and correct me if I'm wrong, your father wanted you and your siblings to be farmers, too. And he sort of gave up and knew all was lost when you guys refused to compete in the Dairy Princess pageant.
That is true.
Now, and why did you refuse to do that, all of you?
In my case, I felt I didn't look good in dotted Swiss. That was my whole, I felt like the ampere waist did not flatter me, although I was very eager to perform the talent portion of the contest. But, we thought we were too good for it. What did we know? You know, so I think on some level, I'll always be considered a failure because I chose not to go out for Dairy Princess. I wish I'd done it.
And so was that the only precursor that you didn't want to be a farmer? I mean, what would that have to do with farming, though?
Well, I think there were, first of all, our farm was not successful.
Oh.
And like many family-owned farms, it failed. Very slow, painful death. So by the time I was of age, there was no question that any of us would inherit anything from that life. But no, I think I always had my tap dancing shoes and a dream. I think I always knew I would leave this area, and I also always knew that it would never leave me, and I come back here constantly.
Really?
I own a house in my hometown, and I spend at least half of my time right here.
You do? I didn't realize that. So this is a form of solace still for you, huh?
Absolutely. I don't know if I would call it solace, but I think of it as being, I feel like myself when I'm here. And I feel that people get me in the way that people do when you've known them forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess who wouldn't love that, to be someplace where you feel understood and where you think you understand things? It's really a treasure. And I've always had that. I've lived in New York City, Washington, D.C., London, now Chicago. But I've also always lived in Freeville. So,
Now that must be difficult to transition from such a small town into big cities. Was that a shock for you when you first did that?
Well, I always wanted to be initially in the news business. And, you know, I worked for the New Yorker magazine and NBC, and I mean, that's where the jobs are. And I think growing up in Freeville, I always loved movies from the 30s and 40s, and I had this idea, like a montage in my head of what life was like in the city. Everybody lived in the Chrysler building, you always wore pearls. You know, I had these ideas about that, and of course, life isn't like that, but I do find city life sort of, there is some sheen or some glamour or something. There's something about city life that I do love.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk to you about the fact that your father left the family when you were 12, and your mother pulled it together for all you guys. She has got to be one of the greatest role models for you, right? And your family? It's quite amazing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's quite amazing.
I mean,
how
but
she
whose
did
father
that.
Hasn't taken off? You know, it seems like everybody I know.
Some of us wish our fathers had.
Really? Well, in my case, it was very dramatic, honestly. And I don't want to be indiscreet, but. My mother was left with a farm, a mortgage, and four adolescent kids.
Mm.
She had not worked outside our property for many, many years, and she went and got a job at Cornell University as a typist. And she somehow made this transition. It was very, very painful, but she put food on the table, and what a thing to watch.
Exactly.
How wonderful to watch your parent step up to the plate, do what needs to be done. It was quite amazing. I'll never forget it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is quite amazing.
And, you know, if you've seen somebody do that, you feel like, well, I can do anything. And my mother never sat us down and said, you can do anything. You know, she never gave us the pep talk. She never did that. What she did was she demonstrated with her own life what could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And her own story is absolutely remarable to me.
Yeah, yeah. I thought so, too, when I was reading your biography and stuff. You say that the church is a great influence, and especially music brought you to church. Talk to us a little bit about the influence.
Well, I've always been, my family's very musical, and we've always, all of us, have done a lot of singing at church. And other places, too, but having just been through the Christmas season, you know, there's something about that old Methodist hymnal. There's absolutely, for me, there's nothing like it. Again, because I feel like that's how I know who I am. That music, you know, I was raised on it, and it's in my, kind of in my heart, and it's very meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm. And you're somebody who isn't afraid to talk about spirituality and the fact that you have a spiritual side.
What do I know? I mean, talking about church is very different for me from talking about spirituality.
Right.
Church has always been where you eat the casseroles and where you spend time with your neighbors. And, you know, our church, the Little Methodist Church on Main Street in Freeville, has this big picture, which are in, it's actually the same thing as in many Methodist churches. I'm sure some tin man came through town and, you know, town after town and sold these. It's a picture of Jesus as imagined by someone who clearly had never met him, if you know what I mean. So I remember sitting in the pews and looking up and thinking that it was Jesus's yearbook picture. He's kind of posed, looking over his shoulder. He looks like the valedictorian of everything, you know? So, but that's different from spiritual, you know, spiritual matters. So I do feel I have a pretty active spiritual life. And I think most people do. And it's something that comes up in my column. And it's something that I really enjoy hearing from people. And I really enjoy talking about spiritual matters in my column. I just think it's very important to people.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of at the core of, for a lot of us, of who we are, how we think, how we feel, how we react to things, and where we're headed.
Mm-hmm. So to you, it's very tied into values and ethics.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And all those good things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I also want to talk about the fact that you left Freeville to go to college, and you've had so many different jobs.
I know.
You know,
what's
receptionist
my problem?
At the New Yorker, producer at NBC. But the one that I want to talk to you about, Amy, is the fact that you were once a lounge singer.
Oh, I know.
That
now
kills me.
I know. Well, it killed a lot of people. I, you know, of course, if I'd been any good at it, I'd still be doing it.
But is it because you liked it?
What happened was, after college, I lived in Washington, and I've always been very bold about trying new things. And I'd always been a singer and never shy. And I was looking for a job, and I walked, you know, a man walked into a bar. I walked into a lounge on M Street in Georgetown, and you know, there's a piano. There was a brandy snifter. What could I do? So I had a little gig there for quite a while. And nothing came of it. You know, I had some regulars who came in. In fact, this is great because I was trying to get a job at NBC, which had a huge bureau in D.C. And I must have had some connection to NBC because I kept trying for that. Like, I didn't interview at other networks for some reason. And I'd had an interview at the bureau, and it went poorly. It went poorly.
To say the least?
To say the least. I mean, you know, we didn't exchange blows or anything, but it was very clear during the interview that they had nothing to offer me. And I was looking for an entry-level job. It was no big deal, but they simply had nothing. And I was singing at this lounge, and these guys used to come in. They became regulars. I had sort of, you know, fans. Who knew? And I got to know them. They worked at NBC. And I said, oh, I have been trying to get a job there. And they said, call us tomorrow. No problem. I called. I had a job within days.
Really?
Yeah, and that's how I started in the news business. And both of those men, one of them, I was working at NPR years and lifetimes later, working at NPR. Pete Mitchell rounded the corner. There he was, the same guy.
Wow.
So, you know, it's really been lovely. I mean, this is somebody who sort of plucked me out of the bar.
Literally. And it sounds like he weaves through your life. He's like the little angel.
Well,
that shows
people
up.
Tend to. People uh-huh. tend to weave through your life, which is why I like to repeat whenever I can. Do not make enemies. Like, I am not the nicest person in the world, but talk about advice. My very first day on the job, I worked the overnight shift at NBC Radio, and we had one of these older women. She was in the first wave of women working in broadcasting, and she gave me a little piece of sisterly advice, if you know what I mean. And she said, that jerk over there, we both started the same day, this boy and I. Same job, same day. But he was like this obnoxious, ambitious jerk who was really jockeying for something. She said, let me tell you something. And I was locking horns with him right off the bat. She said, come here. Let me tell you something. Don't make friends. Don't make enemies. This guy who's such a jerk today, he could end up being your boss. 15 years from now, he could end up being the vice president here. And she said, and trust me, I've known a few vice presidents, and he's a candidate. So it was fantastic advice. I just minded my own business.
Mm-hmm.
And I did make friends, but I didn't make enemies.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, and if you just try to, like, keep your head down, do a good job, be a good sport, you know, it ends up, you know, people want to work with you.
Uh-huh. So you've never had found the need to make political change, though. You know, I mean, sometimes one does have to be assertive and maybe make enemies to stick up for oneself, you know.
Listen,
yeah.
I won't kid you. Sometimes there's a butt that needs to be kissed. I'll do it. You know, that's life in the workplace.
Uh-huh.
I do what needs to be done, but I feel I've been so fortunate because I've worked places that value me and what I bring to it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't, you know, why would you hire me if you want something else? I've always had a very specific point of view. Certainly, any of my writing jobs have been all about me and my voice. So, lucky me.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the end of your singing career, though. I mean, did you really have aspirations to go further? Would you have if fate hadn't intervened?
I did. I would have ended up like, you know, Zelda Fitzgerald, who took up ballet dancing at age 30. You know, I think I've got that in me. So I think I was rescued from attempting to be making a career of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is, the beauty of that is not being a professional musician, the beauty of that is I get to be an amateur musician for the rest of my life.
Oh,
and feel really good about it.
Uh-huh, that's an interesting way of putting
it.
Now, you also wrote a family advice column for Time magazine. Tell us how you got into writing family advice.
Well, I have been doing radio stories, and this is another, like, the star broke her ankle. My life seems full of these very kind of lucky breaks, but I've been doing these radio pieces, and the bureau chief of the Washington Bureau of Time magazine, who was somebody I didn't know, I got a message to call this person, Time Magazine. Honestly, I thought it was a subscription cold call. I mean, and naturally, having no life, I returned the call. And he said, I've been hearing you on the radio, and I can't believe I don't know who you are, but I just started as bureau chief, and I would love to talk to you about I'm trying to hire new talent. So we met. He offered me a staff writing job, and I said no.
You said no?
I did. I said, I am so sorry. I have another job. And he knew I was freelancing for NPR, so he said, I have to tell you, people don't tend to turn these jobs down, and so please forgive me if I ask you why, what your other job is. And I said, I'm trying to raise a person. I was a single mother, and I was piecing together freelance work so that I could be a full-time parent. And I said, I'm trying to raise this person, and I feel like if I do that well, I don't have to do anything else well. And he called me about 3 days later, and he said, you know, we're thinking of starting a column about parenting and family issues, and that might be a great fit for you. And I said, oh, I'll definitely take that. And he said, well, you know that thing where you work as a staffer for 15 years and then you get a column? He said, you just skipped right over all of that. And I said, yeah, I know.
Wow, that's amazing. If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Dickinson. She's the author of the Ask Amy Advice column, which all of you probably read in your newspapers. Let's talk now about how you ended up taking Ann Landers' place for the Chicago Tribune.
Well, first I had to, you know, bump her off. But after that, it was easy. No, she, Ann Landers, I had never written an advice column, but I was freelancing for the Chicago Tribune and a ton of other places. And I was very close friends with the editor I was working with at the Tribune, and he and I had been neighbors at one point. So this was a friend of mine who was also taking pieces from me for the Tribune. And he said to me, if you ever want a job at this paper, you know, I would love to talk to you about that. And yet again, I said, I live in Washington, D.C. Move to Chicago? Are you kidding me? And he said, well, the door is open. He also was new on the job and wanted to hire new people. And when Ann Landers died, I emailed him. And you know those emails you send that are like joke? Like, it was like a joke. I said, well, now there's a job I could do. And I wrote ha, ha, ha across the page, like ho, ho, ho. And he got back to me and he said, you know what? You're right.
Wow.
You could do that. And we think we're going to try and launch a new column, and let's talk. I now refer to that as the joke that swallowed my life, because I went to Chicago to meet with them. I had never been set foot in Chicago. Mm. Within 10 minutes, they were saying, would you move here? How do you feel about that? You know, it was really quite amazing. They had about a dozen serious candidates.
I was going to ask you that, yeah. And what did you have to do? Write a few columns, right?
Well, how else would you try somebody out? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was actually perfect what they did. They made up a couple of questions, and then they used a couple of questions that I'm sure had run in her column at some point. Mm-hmm. I now realize that those five or six questions they gave all of us to answer were very representative of the mail I get. So they were terrific questions. We all got the same questions, and I was here in Freeville, quite out of work, and we were all emailed these questions. I didn't know who the other candidates were, but we were all told, you have a week. Please get this back to us in a week. And I had nothing going on, and so I went ahead and did it. I took 3 or 4 hours. And
wow.
I remember I did some reporting. I called a geneticist at Cornell on this one question. I did some reporting and research, and I sent them back in that afternoon. And the editor emailed me, and he said, I have not read this. I don't intend to read this. You have a week. Please take it. I'm sort of pulling for you. Please, please, please. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I could run down to my mom's house, sit on her porch with my sisters, my aunts, and we could, you know, kind of form a committee and talk about the, you know, like we mm-hmm. could
Yeah, make it perfect.
I could get a lot of help.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I thought, no, this is it. This is what I would do. And actually, honestly, I knew that being fast was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got back to him and I said, no, I'm done. That's my final answer. And I wouldn't change a word given another week. So go ahead and read it. It was so...
That was bold of
you. Well, and you know, I think that was part of it too. I think they felt like, wow, this person really gets it and she feels really good about it. And you know, I did. I answered those questions and I thought, oh, I could definitely do this job.
Mm.
I am fantastic. No, I just thought, oh, this is a really good fit.
Uh-huh.
And they, you know, because... they can't do anything without forming a committee and doing research. They did a lot of test marketing and research of all of the candidates. And according to them, every group tested. They ran 9 separate focus groups. Every single one had the same first choice. Their first choice being to please bring Ann Landers back from the dead. Like, that was number one.
Are you serious?
I am serious. Number two, if you couldn't do that, I would do. Like, I was everybody's...
second choice.
Second choice.
Oh, that must make Ann Landers' family
feel
good.
Yeah.
But really, so you had such an impact. That's quite amazing.
Well, I just
because
think...
I think so many people think this is probably easy.
Oh.
And I'm sure it's not.
Well, but I won't say it's hard. You know, I feel like plowing a field is hard. You know what I'm saying? I feel like... you know, it's snowing today. Riding your bike is hard. You know.
No, I know what you
mean.
But I still think you have to walk a fine line because this is very public.
I know.
People could be damaged.
And I'm blowing it as we speak. I know.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm damaging my career just talking to you right now. But I know it is. It's very public. A big part of it is being sort of this media person.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately for me, I had been a producer. So when I landed on the Today Show, I sort of didn't get freaked out. Because I had worked behind the scenes at the Today Show. Like, you know, so I had all this broadcast media experience that's really helped a lot. But the guts of the column, that's just the job. The column is where it's at. And here's what I love. And I think I get this, too, because I was in radio for such a long time. I look at these letters. They're like individual little voices. I hear people's voices. And that's why, like, I don't edit the letters. I don't rewrite the letters. I love the way people write. I love the way they tell their story. And so if you let somebody tell their own story, it's like you. You ask me a great question, you're going to get a really good answer. So I feel like they help me by, you know, kind of handing me answers.
The essence of the concern.
Mainly it's delightful to do, honestly.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, I understand there was a little bit of controversy about you becoming this person.
There was?
Because you were divorced, single mother. What do you know about
blah, blah, blah.
Did you really get abused, though? No, I'm...
I do. I have...
I've been told that you were...
Oh, yeah.
You know, sort of attacked by a few people.
Well,
right?
And, you know, if you're not being attacked, then you're not yelling loud enough. You know, I feel like I have such a thick skin, but I do have a bulletin board in my office that's covered with... postcards and notes that say things like, what do you know? You're divorced. What do you know? Well, you know what? As a divorced person, I know a lot about marriage. Now, I don't know a lot about a marriage that lasts for 50 years, but I know about, you know, a happy marriage that then loses steam. Mm. I feel like I'm surrounded by relationships. And I don't write that column based only on my own personal knowledge of everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I have been a very involved parent. I feel like I know a lot about that.
Yeah.
I have been absolutely in the trenches of parenting. And I've been on a bunch of blind dates, and that'll teach you a thing or two about human nature.
I would think it'd be like a good novelist. You know,
yeah.
I mean, not all novelists have gone through these experiences that they write
right.
about. Think about somebody like Joyce Carol Oates, who writes about girl gangs and murders and stuff. I mean, so in some ways...
Right. And while I don't dream up, you know, my answers,
right.
I read a lot. I'm very aware of the current thinking and research in different areas. Mm-hmm. And I'm a reporter. I do a lot of reporting. But the voice is mine, and the answers are mine, and all of the choices are mine. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if people want to beat me up because I'm divorced, well, I've already been beat up. You should have seen my divorce. I mean, you know.
Well, I think people enjoy your honesty, though, about all that stuff and your spirituality and the fact that you're divorced and a single mother. You were upfront about that from the beginning. And you could have put on some kind of fake persona.
Oh, really? Do you think that would ever work?
I think it would be tried. I don't know if it would
really work.
Yeah.
You know what? Maybe I would have tried that if I thought I could pull that off, that kind of shenanigans. But I'm one of those people, I always get caught. You know, I always get caught. So, no, I'm very, very honest about my own life.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that serves you well. Now, I want to bring up just one last thing. We only have a few minutes left. Do you have anything in place for situations if you get a letter from somebody where you think somebody really is in danger?
Well, I have gotten a couple of letters like that. And, you know, a lot of the mail that comes in is anonymous. Mm. I did get a letter that came in that really was very alarming, and it had a return address, and I simply wrote a very long reply filled with information and support and resources, and sent it back immediately. And the woman who wrote the letter contacted me later and thanked me and told me that she felt it had helped. And, you know, but I'm not a social service agency.
Right.
I am really aware of that. The nice thing about email is that if somebody contacts me and I've never gotten anything truly alarming, but if a kid contacts me and says I'm really depressed, I can get right back to them.
Mm.
And just a little like, hey, I'm glad you reached out. Where do you live? You know, sometimes I'll ask a kid where they live and I'll say, do me a favor, go to your school guidance counselor and let me know what happens. You know, I just try to keep in touch. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't run an agency. I'm untrained.
Yeah. So you just use common sense.
Well, I try to be supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One final question. Where does Amy Dickinson go for advice?
My mom, of course. You know what? I'm the youngest in a very large family. I'm surrounded by advice. Surrounded.
So you turn to your family.
And my community. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, Amy, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you well. Continue writing the column. It's quite amusing. I enjoy reading it myself.
Thank you, Tish. Now I feel like I need a theme song. Ask Amy. You know, something snappy. We should work on that.
We will work on that. Thank you so much. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.